The medium is the message, body makes a dance. Love is the product, the joke is in, the joke is in, the joke is in your face.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters and eventually the end of the world. 2012. Depending on your orientation, it might be the year Jeb Bush squares off against Barack Obama in a presidential election, or the year that you plan to buy your third house or get that sixth change you've always been waiting for, or it might be the end of the Mayan calendar, when the whole world will flip out and everyone will become enlightened. Today's guest, Daniel Pinchbeck, is the author of a new book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and he's not planning to campaign for Jeb Bush in 2012. And we'll be talking to him soon. But before I welcome my hosts, I want to remind you to come to our website, areyouseriousradio.com, where we're taking audio comments. And if you know how to use audio, come on and talk to us. And if you don't, figure it out. And I'd like to welcome our panel today. Jeff Diehl is here, as usual. And Steve Robles is sipping on a brew.
Greetings, Earthlings.
And Diana Brown might be sipping on a brew, too, or she's going to have to go back into rehab.
Back we all might have to go, because this may shock you all, but pass the banana daiquiris, because apparently humans drink like monkeys, or vice versa. Well, I was on Boing Boing, and I read that a new study that was published in the journal Methods indicates that booze affects monkeys much the same way it affects people. Now, anybody's ever watched the Banana Splits probably thought this, but science has now confirmed it to be true. And would you like to know about it? The first experiment, we've got 21 female monkeys, 21 girl monkeys. They're all put together, and they're given this artificially sweetened ethanol concoction during a big group happy hour.
And then they all run into the bathroom to put on their makeup?
At the same time, yes. Because it doesn't matter if you're a boy monkey or a girl monkey.
Okay,
I know my sound completely spiked out there, because that is definitely something I have issues with, like women in the bathroom at the same time, and then the seats not being... Anyway, moving on.
What
use
kind of
the cowboy
are
hats. These monkeys, good question. See, Jeff is always there. These are the racist Marcacas monkeys.
Macaques.
Wait a second,
see?
The racist Marcacas monkeys?
Oh, if only that were so simple. The rhesus.
Oh,
macaque monkeys.
Reese's like peanut butter?
Delicious, my monkey and your chocolate.
So tell us more about
this. Okay, well, more about this. So you've got all the girl monkeys, and they're all together. They're just hooting it up and drinking. Then they took 10 monkeys. They separated them. And these lonely monkeys drank more.
Now, these are still girl monkeys?
They're still girl monkeys. And they drank a lot more, like 2 to 3 times more. So then they gave boy monkeys 24/7 access to the sweetened hooch, and apparently they wanted to drink more immediately after work. So the happy hour is something that we share with them, boy monkeys, girl monkeys alike. Now, of course, there were some differences in situations like status, and there was difference in, you know, how they were housed and the pecking order of things. But like humans, they were very individual in how they responded to alcoholism. So some would drink incessantly and some wouldn't really touch it at all. So, of course, the scientists are hoping to solve human alcoholism.
What do monkeys do when the men are buying the women a drink?
Yeah.
See, this is a great question. I wanted to know more about these monkeys. So I went and did some research, and on Wikipedia I learned a lot of things, among which the mating season is not really confined to a specific time. So a couple of drunken monkeys are probably as likely to hook up at a happy hour as, like, I don't know, the guy in the cube next to you and the new temp in reception. But it'll probably be the girl monkey that does the hooking up first, because in the wild...
With another girl monkey, right?
Yeah. Are they hot? Are the girl monkeys hot? That's
because Jeff is my friend, I want to tell him it's going going to be most likely some girl-on-girl monkey action. But, you know, it's split right down just like with humans. And so,
but do guy monkeys fling their poo at girls like I do when I'm out at a bar?
Definitely, yeah. Which is, you know, a good way to attract a girl monkey.
Oh,
fling
it
the
works
poo.
Every time.
And, you know, your mentioning that made me think about monkeys' drinking habits in other walks of life. You know, rhesus monkeys like, you know, the pet monkey of the crazy rich guy. Or
I have to say, though, flinging drunken poo is a lot more challenging.
Because you're aiming.
You know
off.
What I'm saying? It doesn't have the same. Never mind.
Okay, so maybe like there's the organ grinder monkey on a street corner, or the city zoo monkey in his habitat. So then I started thinking, like, maybe the organ grinder monkey like sneaks bottles of fortified hooch into the zoo monkey, and then the rich guy's monkey's back on Park Avenue, sipping his banana daiquiri, looking out his expensive prison window.
Sounds like a monkey conspiracy.
A monkey conspiracy. Well, the thing I want to say, getting out of this, is, you know, it's not unusual for them to see the monkeys stumble and fall or sway or vomit just like humans. So whether you believe
just
in evolution...
Just like Jeff.
Just like Jeff. So whether you're an evolutionist or a creationist, monkey's uncle or no, humans and monkeys all get drunk on the joy juice the same way. So here's to you, monkeys. Drink up.
We're here talking to Daniel Pinchbeck, and he's the author of 2012, The Return of Steve Robles. Say this properly for me.
I believe it's Quetzalcoatl.
Okay. The Return of...
Actually, I think the L apparently is silent, so it's Quetzalcoatl.
Quetzalcoatl. Oh, all right. So now we got the real expertise
nice.
Here. I said it completely wrong in the introduction, but everybody who listens knows I'm kind of goofy anyway. So Mr. Pinchbeck here has written for the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Esquire, and Art Forum. And this book is just came out about a month ago. His earlier book, last book, Breaking Open the Head, released in 2002, was widely recognized as one of the great books about psychedelic exploration. I liked it myself, that's for sure. And he's currently editorial...
Psychedelic exploration of the book.
Actually, I mean, I'd hate to have to compare them, but anyway, he's currently editorial director of Evolver magazine, which is also just starting up. And welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So Terrence McKenna used to call DMT, let me see if I can do this right, the great convincer... And in Breaking Open the Head, and also in the opening of 2012, it is sort of the story of how you became convinced and by your trip through hallucinogens particularly. And tell us a little bit about what you became convinced of and how that occurred.
Yeah, right. Well, the first book was really charts kind of my... learning curve as I explored these different shamanic cultures and had these experiences, and including in the West Africa with the Bleedi tribe taking iboga, and in Ecuador working with Sequoia Indians taking ayahuasca. And over a few years of having these journeys and making these explorations, I began to have kind of experiences that were particularly occult or synchronistic or telepathic, and it really shifted over time my whole worldview away from kind of the materialist paradigm that I'd been in to having to sort of take seriously this kind of shamanic, psychic, and intuitive reality. And definitely DMT was very convincing in terms of just being plunged into an alien reality that seemed, you know, very, very well detailed and seemed to have its own laws and logic going on.
Was there a particular moment where you experienced something that, although you were on, say, hallucinogens, you felt that you couldn't just credit it to the hallucinogens? But I can remember being in that space a number of times while on hallucinogens where I go, my God, this isn't just the drug, there's something happening. But a year later, I can't quite remember why I became convinced that something else definitely is happening.
Yeah, well, for me, it wasn't... I mean, I don't think the hallucinogenic experience by itself is totally convincing of anything. It was more kind of like a matching up or paralleling of these experiences I had and how it influenced my dream life and synchronicities that occurred in my real-world existence that began to kind of move me step by step into this other understanding.
And in this current book, I mean, 2012, of course, is in many ways sort of a hippie mythology, a counterculture mythology as a result of Terence McKenna and some other people. And what you're talking about in some ways is sort of a singularity. And as a matter of coincidence, I went to a singularity conference yesterday at Stanford about a technological singularity. And in some ways, talking to you would be like a completely radical contrast with everything that was going on there. In other ways, we're talking about the same thing, radical evolution, mutation, something that will happen that beyond which we can't quite understand from our current state of consciousness. Now, how would you contrast your notion of what we might call a singularity with, say, the Kurzweilian notion?
Yeah, I sort of critique the whole singularity concept in the book. I see it as a very kind of masculine, kind of rationalistic attempt to kind of put a cap on what's going on, that we want to sort of culminate in the singularity. And I also think that this whole technological euphoria has to be deeply interrogated. So in the book, I sort of move from the idea of a technological singularity to a multiplicity of technique, and really thinking about technique as something maybe more interesting than technology. Because technology, our euphoria for technology is always putting us into the future, and that we see this, imagine this amazing thing which is coming down the line. And what really interests me is more like going into imminence, like connecting deeper with the present, and recognizing that the present is all we got. You know, this is the only moment that ever was or will be. So for me, we actually need to turn away from this like technological euphoria. And also, when we look at technology, with every new level of technology, it brings a whole new host of problems, you know, whether it's biotechnology, seeds now spreading contamination and biopollution, you know, God knows what nanotechnology will do. So I think there's a little bit of a wrong direction there. And for me, what I see really coming down the pike is more of a psychic transformation. I think that the way one sort of matrix I use for understanding what's happening is, if you think about where people were in the 1750s with electricity, you know, they'd seen lightning, they'd experienced static shocks, but they had no idea you could create an industrial grid and transform a planet with electricity. I think we're in a very similar place right now with psychic phenomena, that more and more people are becoming aware of synchronicities, of telepathic shifts and effects, but we don't really know what to do with this knowledge yet. We don't have a system that allows us to apply these realizations. So I would think that might be something that's going to happen between now and 2012.
Do you think it's going to take the form of some kind of psychic? I mean, you could look at somebody like Edison as a kind of messiah of technology. Do you think that some single form or being could actually advance that in the way that Edison advanced technology?
I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, it seems to me it's coming from a lot of different directions. I mean, one thing that really interests me is, part of the book is, you know, the book is very much about prophecies, and I look at the Hopi Indians and visited them and talked about the Hopi prophecies. And it may be that indigenous groups like the Hopi are preserving aspects of a knowledge system that we may want to take seriously. I talk in the book about how this Cambridge anthropologist wrote about a book about the Hopi, and he was a total materialist, but he said, look, you know, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but sometimes I'd go to these rain dances, and, you know, it would be a clear blue sky, 120 degrees, and after half an hour, the clouds would gather and rain would start to fall. And he also talked about sort of telepathic capacities that the Hopi elders seemed to possess and had sort of maintained. So it seems to me that considering what's happening with the climate, and this kind of massive biospheric crisis that we're unleashing, the ability to use collective psychic energy in ritual or in some kind of focused state of awareness to shift weather conditions or other aspects of reality might be something legitimate. It might be something that we actually have to learn very seriously and kind of reapproach these indigenous cultures with no condescension or no patronizing attitude, which is what we've done up to this point, and really rethink their relationship to reality.
On the other hand, during hurricane season, we might want to put a moratorium on rain dances. It might help.
Right.
Prevent a Katrina.
I guess, I mean, the rain dance example and a whole bunch of other things in your book. Raises the question of what is a coincidence and What can we say as a result of you know, some of these activities? I mean, what comes out of our perception, you know, our expectation, our noticing that stuff seems to happen, and how do you delineate between coincidence and something really mysterious actually happening?
Right. Yeah. So for me, there's a whole shift in worldview, which is implied, which seems to be what the Mayans were operating with, was a sense of synchronicity or synchronization. You know, so even this 2012 event is based on a kind of astronomical alignment between the Earth and the Sun and the black hole or dark rift at the center of the Milky Way, which they'd identified as the cosmic mother or black hole, and which we've only recently realized is in fact a huge black hole in the last like 5 or 6 years. So it seems like in many ways we'd have to reapproach this kind of non-dualistic conception of reality.
Now, you have a whole section in there on the Mayan pyramids, and that seemed to be pretty extraordinary, actually. Can you describe how are the Mayan pyramids an expression of mathematical forms and of time, and what do they represent, and what are they communicating?
Right, yeah, I mean, I don't take any credit for having figured this stuff out. It's this guy, Carl Johan Kallman, who's written a few books, including The Mind Calendar and The Transformation of Consciousness. And he noted that the major pyramids in Maya land were these nine-step pyramids, and somehow worked it out that looking at the sort of Mayan sacred calendar, which is a 260-day count or 260 kind of factor, 13x20 matrix, that this nine-stage pyramid represented a nine-level process in the evolution of consciousness, each stage being 20 times faster in linear time, and each stage also having a kind of alternation of a 13-part kind of light and dark energy current. And he just goes through it very systematically, all the way back down to the bottom stage, which started around 16 billion years ago. So we're in a stage that began in 1999. So we're now experiencing, according to his system, his idea, in 360 days, the amount of kind of change and transformation that people were experiencing in about 20 years before 1999 and in roughly 400 years before 1755. It's pretty amazing to take that in, but when you really hold that idea in your mind and really get his whole thought conception, to me, it seems intuitively very, very correct. In a way, it's a more rigorous approach to the kind of ideas that Terence McKenna was exploring with the time wave.
At the very least, it's impressive, you know, the calendrical skills that they had without access to particular kinds of technology and knowledge that we presume to have. Now, 2012 in the Mayan calendar has been, as I said before, largely associated with the psychedelic philosopher Terence McKenna, and then with Mr. Jose Arguelles, famous for the so-called harmonic convergence back in 1987. And for me, your portrayal of Arguelles was pretty scary. Basically what he says is if we don't get with his new calendar, like immediately everybody's going to die. Does that sort of thing strike you as having sort of totalitarian implications and potentials, cult potential and that sort of thing? Do you worry about that?
Arguelles was one of the most difficult kind of characters for me to deal with in the book. I mean, his ideas, once I really went into them and sat with them, I think that he's actually an amazing culture hero and has philosophically come up with some very, very profound sort of uncoverings for our time. On the other hand, there's something very strident about his pronouncements. There's a kind of, you know, he believes that he's the incarnation of Paco Vatan, this 8th century Mayan king, and there's a kind of atavistic kind of tone that his pronouncements get into. It's very much like a Mayan king. For me, I sort of finally talked about him being maybe like possessed by this archetype that he was working with. However, I think that this idea of a calendar transformation is one that the more I went into it and the more angles I looked at it from, it just began to seem very, very deep. So that basically that the fact that our Gregorian calendar is desynchronized from natural cycles, and originally the months were moons, you know, connected to the lunar cycles, the fact that our calendar is no longer connected to these natural cycles has this effect of desynchronizing us and alienating us from the natural world. And also, if you think about it, it's like the male dominator kind of solar rationality has supplanted entirely the more kind of lunar, feminine, intuitive relationship to reality. So a new calendar potentially could integrate rationality and intuition, feminine and masculine, lunar and solar, and perhaps give us a template for more harmonic global civilization.
Well, if they institute the new calendar, I mean, that would make Y2K look like Girl Scout party, I would imagine, but maybe that's to be desired.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really I think it's a very positive vision, and it's a very fascinating one. And one thing you notice in revolutionary situations, one of the first things that happens almost like intuitively is this institution of a new calendar, like in the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. But these calendars have just been another kind of artificial imposition. So for me, it's like really, if we take in this knowledge system fully and these ideas fully, then maybe there's a way that we can, you know, actually kind of create a more harmonic template. And I think it's interesting also that the book in 2012 is very much about the nature of time and the fact that this shift in consciousness is a different understanding or relationship to time. So if we embodied that, materialize that in a new calendar, we could actually say that new time was retroactive. So all of these kind of increasingly malfunctioning institutions, like third world debt structures and the banking system and nation-state charters, could actually be like delegitimized in that one gesture, and we could actually create like a whole new template for global civilization. And for me, that's also interesting if you think about the relationship between technology and social organizations. So, for instance, every time there's a profound new kind of media technology, it leads to new social organization. Like, we couldn't have had mass democracy without the printing press. And clearly, kind of, the internet is suggestive of a new form of social organization.
We need to break for a moment. We're going to listen to a tune, and then we'll be right back.
All right, is everybody ready? I want to.
Mm-hmm.
We're back with Daniel Pinchbeck.
I'm just wondering if can we have a Mayan swimsuit calendar? can we just integrate some of these disciplines into one overarching philosophy?
Yeah, why not?
I like that question. I like that answer.
We embrace your openness.
Most questions should be answered in that.
You've got a good attitude for the Are You Serious show. You passed the first part
why
of the
not?
Test.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm not a hardcore rationalist, or I'm not a hardcore anything really. But I do worry about the tendency for hippies and New Age types, not to characterize yourself or myself or anybody as that, but maybe some of the people who might read your book and be influenced by it, to believe in pretty much anything and everything. And I mean, once you take logic away from the helm and say that everything is subjective, what basis do you have for choosing any one story over any other story, or does that matter?
Yeah, I mean, those are really deep questions, and they're sort of at the core of the whole investigation for me. And yeah, I think that belief is kind of the enemy, in a sense, that there are certain things, you have certain experiences, and you establish kind of knowledge for yourself of certain things. I mean, Carl Jung talked about how, you know, he believed only what he knew. So yeah, I think that, you know, that you can establish certain forms of knowledge. I mean, I had this whole experience with Quetzalcoatl, this kind of prophetic transmission that's in the book. And, you know, do I know that that's a legitimate and meaningful experience? I don't. I mean, it was an experience that I went through, and as candidly and honestly as possible, I tried to explore it and describe what happened. But I kind of leave it open to the reader and also to myself in a way, like what or if there's deeper significance to that.
Now, you sort of say, I mean, in the book that you're a messenger for, I'm sorry, I still can't say it.
Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, yeah. Quetzalcoatl. Right, and he only had, like, what, one big hit, Oye Como Va, right? So it's hard to remember. But you say that you're a but you're saying that, not to take this too particularly literally, or that you're uncertain about it, is that what I'm getting?
What's that?
When you say that belief is the enemy, and then you talk about being a messenger for this being.
Well, that was this sort of transmission that came through, which I put out there because it was, you know, absolutely part of my process.
Did you worry about including that in the book? I mean, think, oh boy, everybody's going to think I really went over the
top? Totally. Yeah, for sure. You know, and I'm sure. I mean, there's. You know, but at a certain point, I was just like, I decided I was just going to go for it.
Right.
In terms of, like, you know, it seems like, I feel there's a lot of people who have gone into this material to a certain extent and vibe on it to a certain extent, but they're not really willing to go the distance. And for me, it's only by that kind of full disclosure and full exposure and kind of really full commitment to seeking out the kind of depths of these questions that we can hope to sort of move into any kind of new cultural paradigm or new thought system.
Well, I certainly give you props for being a brave explorer, as people will discover from reading the book. And one of the best things in the book are really when you're talking about yourself and your own experience, and you're tying in these ideas and philosophies into your own experiences. There are a few parts where I got lost. I found a little hard to stick with. There are a few parts, but I can sort of pinpoint it with the material about Rudolf Steiner, where it just seems to be a bunch of random assertions about how the universe is constructed. And let me see if I can find my notes on that. But that says some. Here it is, a quote from you. In his lectures, Steiner proposed that humans were inverted plants, the Buddha incarnated on Mars after he left Earth, and that the beehive is a gift from Venus, which, of course, it also reminds me of Gurdjieff saying that humans are food for the moon. So, I mean, am I right? Does this just seem like random assertions?
Well, yeah, I think Steiner is you know, certainly a very complicated figure, and, you know, but what I said in that bit was, you know, that he would make these crazy assertions and ideas, and at first I'd be like, that's totally absurd. And I had the same reaction to Terence McKenna when I first read it, but I had the same reaction to José Arguelles when I first read his stuff, too. But these ideas when you sit with them, they begin to take on a kind of resonance, or they can take on a kind of resonance, you know, when you read his work. And, you know, for me, like, that's what I also tried to suggest in the book or discuss, that kind of occult cosmologies have an interesting relationship to truth, or they suggest a different relationship to truth. When I talked about Nietzsche's idea, maybe there isn't a singular truth. That's just a concept we have. The truth is more like a system of values, the way a painter uses values in a painting. And I also talked about William Irwin Thompson, who noted that all these different occult cosmologies were almost like different compositions, like musical compositions. And so maybe reality is actually as much of a kind of musical, or kind of harmonic, or aesthetic gesture than it is like there's this singular, you know, scientific ultimate authority truth that we're going to discover. Maybe it's much more mysterious than that.
Isn't that emotional resonance that you're talking about really the only necessary component of mythology? I mean, does mythology need to be deconstructed in a way that makes sense? McKenna, believed in some kind of new mythology that would eventually transplant and take away these old, you know, centuries old mythologies that still kind of grip a lot of the general populace.
Right, yeah, I don't think it's just an emotional resonance, and I think there's an intellectual process. I mean, Steiner really talks about thinking as being, I mean, it's too much to go into in this interview, but I mean, if you read his book, Philosophy of Freedom, I think he was very much an intellectual, and for him, thinking was a spiritual path, and he really did the best he could to convey how he'd arrived at his kind of system. And then he also apparently had kind of direct visionary knowledge. And there are a lot of his books where it's very close, it's the closest in language that I found to certain experiences you have on ayahuasca trips, the kind of visions you see there. And, you know, for instance, I mean, he talked about the mission of his life on Earth was actually to bring the knowledge of reincarnation back to the West. And then not only did people reincarnate, but the planet itself reincarnated. This was the fourth incarnation of the Earth, which is amazingly similar to what the Hopis and the Mayans and the Aztecs all talked about, that this is the fourth world or the fifth sun, and we're on the verge of this next incarnation. So I don't know, I think that there's a lot of very, very fascinating, difficult material in Steiner, and I think he's going to be a treasure trove for people who are interested in this material.
You mentioned reincarnation. I have to say that you hit a lot of the hot buttons for people who don't like this sort of discourse. And I mean, there's a huge section on crop circles. There's UFOs. You kind of hit all the points that a lot of people consider sort of National Enquirer type material. But the crop circle, you know, I had never actually. I mean, I so rejected the notion of crop circles that I never paid like one sentence worth of attention to
exactly.
It. So, I mean, it actually is kind of a pretty interesting story. You want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, I think with all of these areas, you know, that's one of the main things the book is, I would say, trying to do is I think we can begin to see that there's more to these areas than we've allowed. There's actually scientists who've kind of been working to sort of substantiate, for instance, with reincarnation. There's this University of Virginia professor, Ian Stevenson, who wrote this, you know, 2,500-page book. He went all around the world finding children who had past life memories. He often, you can actually see photographs on the internet, I believe, where he matched the wounds that these corpses had of these past incarnations with the birthmarks that these kids had. And these were really spontaneous kind of memories. And with the crop circles, there are these biophysicists who've been studying what happens to plants in these formations and have discovered that there's a kind of microwave radiation that's causing like blown nodes and heliotropism that really could not be explained by sticks and boards. And then also there was Gerald Hawkins, who was a astronomy professor and a mathematician, and he found very, very subtle new Euclidean paradigms, even in very simple formations. And other people have discovered more and more really extraordinary kind of material like that with these formations. So whoever is creating this phenomenon, or whatever is creating this phenomenon, is a very subtle and advanced kind of intelligence that also seems to be quite playful. And when you get into the whole study of the crop circles, it's like this kind of synchronicity vortex. I mean, the only way that I could end up sort of thinking about it, and it was really like keeping me up night, I was staying in England for the summer and going out to new formations all the time, was really to think about it as a teaching. teaching on the nature of reality that was really geared to the modern Western mind. And part of that teaching for me was really about how consciousness is involved in co-creating what reality is, or what we sort of take in as reality. So that what I noted was that when people came into the phenomenon, however their kind of set and setting, whatever their intent was what sort of came reflected back at them. So if they were skeptics, they found all this evidence that confirmed skepticism. If they were New Agers, they would have like light body activation. You know, they would see UFOs and balls of light. And there was just all these different levels of this phenomenon, and it really seemed to depend on how you approached it, that how it would open up to you.
So they were more of a magnifying influence for what you were currently experiencing.
What's that?
The crop circles were sort of like a magnifying filter for whatever state of mind you were currently experiencing.
Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, they kind of are kind of tools for deliteralizing. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's something. There are crop circles where it's really hard to collapse them to a single causal explanation. It's a fascinating and tricky phenomenon. And I think there's a lot of good reason to think that it's not all being done by human hoaxers.
As you read along, I mean, you do get effectively give that impression that no environmental artist could possibly like scoop down and like, you know, in the middle of the night in one evening and create something of this extreme. You know, probably tend to be like an art project that would take a long period of time to do some of the things that seem to be there.
Yeah.
So, but it's what's interesting to me is, I mean, there are a lot of narratives in our culture about phenomena that seem to be inexplicable. I mean, you can find the same thing in conspiracy theories where, you know, if you follow the narrative along, then you decide that the mainstream story for 9/11 couldn't possibly be true. And then I always back off a little bit and say, you know, I'm gonna wait a little while before buying into this mystery.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a question of buying into anything. For me, it's really like, you know, I would say the basic lesson of the whole book was just learning how to pay more attention. You know, and the more you pay attention, these kind of mysteries keep opening up. You know. And that's an exciting thing, and I really do hope that the message of the book is a hopeful one. I mean, I do think that we're going to probably go through a critical passage the next few years, but I think that there's the opportunity to potentially create a sort of higher level civilization. That seems to be the message that comes through.
Before we let you go, I mean, let's get into the nub of it. I mean, what exactly is 2012, which I don't think we've quite hit, and what do you think might happen?
Well, 2012, as I mentioned, is this alignment between the Earth and the Sun and the dark rift in the center of the Milky Way. But I'm not really, I mean, although the book is titled 2012, and certainly it's coming up fast, the actual date itself doesn't really concern me. I mean, I got very interested in this Carl Kalman mathematical look at the Mayan calendar, and he notes that according to his system, which is this kind of fractal model of time, kind of we're moving in towards a very, very difficult period, which would be the year 2008, which sort of corresponds to the Nazi Holocaust period in the previous cycle of time. And he suggested that period of around 2008, we might see a kind of global sort of social economic meltdown, which seems pretty parallel to a lot of what I've been reading in terms of peak oil scenarios and just this kind of very, very accelerated situation that we've gone into with resource depletion and water, you know, water scarcity and so on. So it may be that that's kind of like this narrows point where if there is a kind of more positive paradigm being disseminated about how we could move into a different relationship to the Earth and to each other, we might be able to really make it a positive thing. But if there is no kind of better vision or even kind of model or underlying system or structure, then it might become very chaotic and a little bit like a descent into a kind of road warrior scenario.
I want to thank talking to us from definitively a different time zone, at least 3 hours ahead of us, if not entirely in another space and time. And this book was a lot of fun to read. I want to recommend that to anybody will find it interesting. 2012, The Return of
Quetzalcoatl.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun. Love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?